Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Section 11 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Saved the Army. Continued. I was lying there with the one thought still consuming me, how to wait a few hours and to get at that pile of fagots above my head, when the door of my prison opened and a man entered. Had my hands been free, I should have flown at his throat, for it was none other than de Pombal. A couple of brigands were at his heels, but he ordered them back and closed the door behind him. "You villain!" said I. "Hush!" he cried. "Speak low, for I do not know who may be listening, and my life is at stake. I have some words to say to you, Colonel Gerard. I wish well to you, as I did to your dead companion. As I spoke to you beside his body, I saw that we were surrounded and that your capture was unavoidable. I should have shared your fate had I hesitated. I instantly captured you myself so as to preserve the confidence of the band. Your own sense will tell you that there was nothing else for me to do. I do not know now whether I can save you, but at least I will try." This was a new light upon the situation. I told him that I could not tell how far he spoke the truth, but that I would judge him by his actions. "I ask nothing better," said he. "A word of advice to you. The chief will see you now. Speak him fair, or he will have you sawn between two planks. Contradict nothing he says. Give him such information as he wants. It is your only chance. If you can gain time, something may come in our favour. Now I have no more time. Come at once, or suspicion may be awakened." He helped me to rise, and then, opening the door, he dragged me out very roughly, and with the aid of the fellows outside, he brutally pushed and thrust me to the place where the guerrilla chief was seated, with his rude followers gathered round him. A remarkable man was Manuelo, the Smiler. He was fat and florid and comfortable, with a big, clean-shaven face and a bald head, the very model of a kindly father of a family. As I looked at his honest smile, I could scarcely believe that this was indeed the infamous ruffian whose name was a horror through the English army as well as our own. It is well known that Trent, who was a British officer, afterward had the fellow hanged for his brutalities. He sat upon a boulder, and he beamed upon me, like one who meets an old acquaintance. I observed, however, that one of his men leaned upon a long saw, and the sight was enough to cure me of all delusions. "Good evening, Colonel Gerard," said he. "We have been highly honoured by General Massena's staff. Major Cortex one day, Colonel Duplessis the next, and now Colonel Gerard. Possibly the Marshal himself may be induced to honour us with a visit. You have seen Duplessis, I understand. Cortex, you will find nailed to a tree down yonder. It only remains to be decided how we can best dispose of yourself." It was not a cheering speech, but all the time his fat face was wreathed in smiles, and he lisped out his words in the most mincing and amiable fashion. Now, however, he suddenly leaned forward, and I read a very real intensity in his eyes. "Colonel Gerard," said he, "I cannot promise you your life, for it is not our custom, but I can give you an easy death, or I can give you a terrible one. Which shall it be? What do you wish me to do in exchange?
If you would die easy, I ask you to give me truthful answers to the questions which I ask.
A sudden thought flashed through my mind. You wish to kill me, said I. It cannot matter to you how I die. If I answer your questions, will you let me choose the manner of my own death?
Yes, I will, said he, so long as it is before midnight tonight.
Swear it, I cried.
The word of a Portuguese gentleman is sufficient, said he.
Not a word will I say until you have sworn it. He flushed with anger, and his eyes swept round toward the saw, but he understood from my tone that I meant what I said, and that I was not a man to be bullied into submission. He pulled a cross from under his zamarra, or jacket of black sheepskin.
I swear it, said he.
Oh, my joy as I heard the words! What an end! What an end for the first swordsman of France! I could have laughed with delight at the thought. Now, your questions, said I.
You swear in turn to answer them truly?
I do, upon the honour of a gentleman and of a soldier. It was, as you perceive, a terrible thing that I promised, but what was it compared to what I might gain by compliance?
This is a very fair and very interesting bargain, said he, taking a notebook from his pocket. Would you kindly turn your gaze toward the French camp?
Following the direction of his gesture, I turned and looked down upon the camp in the plain beneath us. In spite of the 15 miles, one could, in that clear atmosphere, see every detail with the utmost distinctness. There were the long squares of our tents and our huts, with the cavalry lines and the dark patches which marked the 10 batteries of artillery. How sad to think of my magnificent regiment waiting down yonder, and to know that they would never see their colonel again. With one squadron of them, I could have swept all these cutthroats off the face of the earth. My eager eyes filled with tears as I looked at the corner of the camp, where I knew that there were 800 men, any one of whom would have died for his colonel. But my sadness vanished when I saw beyond the tents the plumes of smoke which marked the headquarters at Torre Novas. There was Massena, and, please God, at the cost of my life, his mission would that night be done. A spasm of pride and exultation filled my breast. I should have liked to have had a voice of thunder that I might call to them, "Behold, it is I, Etienne Gerard, who will die in order to save the army of Clausel." It was indeed sad to think that so noble a deed should be done, and that no one should be there to tell the tale.
"Now," said the brigand chief, "you see the camp, and you see also the road which leads to Combra. It is crowded with your fourgons and your ambulances. Does this mean that Massena is about to retreat?"
One could see the dark moving lines of wagons with an occasional flash of steel from the escort. There could, apart from my promise, be no indiscretion in admitting that which was already obvious. "He will retreat," said I.
"By Combra?"
"I believe so."
"But the army of Clausel?"
I shrugged my shoulders.
"Every path to the south is blocked. No message can reach them. If Massena falls back, the army of Clausel is doomed."
"It must take its chance," said I.
"How many men has he?"
"I should say about 14,000.
"How much cavalry?"
"One brigade of Montbrun's division."
"What regiments?"
"The 4th Chasseurs, the 9th Hussars, and the regiment of Cuirassiers."
"Quite right," said he, looking at his notebook. "I can tell you speak the truth, and heaven help you if you don't."
Then, division by division, he went over the whole army, asking the composition of each brigade. Need I tell you that I would have had my tongue torn out before I would have told him such things, had I not a greater end in view? I would let him know all, if I could but save the army of Clausel. At last he closed his notebook and replaced it in his pocket.
"I am obliged to you for this information, which shall reach Lord Wellington tomorrow," said he. "You have done your share of the bargain. It is for me now to perform mine. How would you wish to die? As a soldier, you would no doubt prefer to be shot, but some think that a jump over the Merodal precipice is really an easier death. A good few have taken it, but we were unfortunately never able to get an opinion from them afterward. There is the saw, too, which does not appear to be popular. We could hang you, no doubt, but it would involve the inconvenience of going down to the wood. However, a promise is a promise, and you seem to be an excellent fellow, so we will spare no pains to meet your wishes." "You said," I answered, "that I must die before midnight. I will choose, therefore, just 1 minute before that hour." "Very good," said he. "Such clinging to life is rather childish, but your wishes shall be met. As to the method," I added, "I love a death which all the world can see. Put me on yonder pile of faggots and burn me alive, as saints and martyrs have been burned before me. That is no common end, but one which an emperor might envy." The idea seemed to amuse him very much. "Why not?" said he. "If Massena has sent you to spy upon us, he may guess what the fire upon the mountain means." "Exactly," said I. "You have hit upon my very reason. He will guess, and all will know, that I have died a soldier's death." "I see no objection whatever," said the brigand with his abominable smile. "I will send some goat's flesh and wine into your hut. The sun is sinking, and it is nearly 8 o'clock. In 4 hours, be ready for your end." It was a beautiful world to be leaving. I looked at the golden haze below, where the last rays of the sinking sun shone upon the blue waters of the winding Tagus, and gleamed upon the white sails of the English transports. Very beautiful it was, and very sad to leave, but there are things more beautiful than that. The death that is died for the sake of others, honour and duty and loyalty and love, these are the beauties far brighter than any which the eye can see. My breast was filled with admiration for my own most noble conduct, and with wonder whether any soul would ever come to know how I had placed myself in the heart of the beacon which saved the army of Clausel. I hoped so, and I prayed so, for what a consolation it would be to my mother, what an example to the army, what a pride to my hussars. When de Pombal came at last into my hut with the food and the wine, the first request I made him was that he would write an account of my death and send it to the French camp. He answered not a word, but I ate my supper with a better appetite from the thought that my glorious fate would not be altogether unknown. I had been there about 2 hours when the door opened again and the chief stood looking in. I was in darkness, but a brigand with a torch stood beside him, and I saw his eyes and his teeth gleaming as he peered at me. "Ready?" he asked. "It is not yet time." "You stand out for the last minute?" "A promise is a promise." "Very good, be it so. We have a little justice to do among ourselves, for one of my fellows has been misbehaving. We have a strict rule of our own, which is no respecter of persons, as de Pombal here could tell you. Do you truss him and lay him on the faggots, de Pombal, and I will return to see him die." De Pombal and the man with the torch entered while I heard the steps of the chief passing away. De Pombal closed the door. "Colonel Gerard," said he, "you must trust this man, for he is one of my party. It is neck or nothing. We may save you yet, but I take a great risk, and I want a definite promise. If we save you, will you guarantee that we have a friendly reception in the French camp, and that all the past will be forgotten?"
"I do guarantee it."
"And I trust your honour. Now, quick, quick, there is not an instant to lose. If this monster returns, we shall die horribly, all three."
I stared in amazement at what he did. Catching up a long rope, he wound it round the body of my dead comrade, and he tied a cloth round his mouth so as to almost cover his face.
"Do you lie there?" he cried, and he laid me in the place of the dead body. "I have four of my men waiting, and they will place this upon the beacon." He opened the door and gave an order. Several of the brigands entered and bore out Duplessis. For myself, I remained upon the floor, with my mind in a turmoil of hope and wonder. 5 minutes later, de Pombal and his men were back. "You are laid upon the beacon," said he. "I defy anyone in the world to say it is not you, and you are so gagged and bound that no one can expect you to speak or move. Now it only remains to carry forth the body of Duplessis and to toss it over the Miradal precipice." Two of them seized me by the head and two by the heels and carried me stiff and inert from the hut. As I came into the open air, I could have cried out in my amazement. The moon had risen above the beacon, and there, clear outlined against its silver light, was the figure of the man stretched upon the top. The brigands were either in their camp or standing round the beacon, for none of them stopped or questioned our little party. De Pombal led them in the direction of the precipice. At the brow we were out of sight, and there I was allowed to use my feet once more. De Pombal pointed to a narrow, winding track. "This is the way down," said he, and then suddenly, "Dios mio, what is that?" A terrible cry had risen out of the woods beneath us. I saw that De Pombal was shivering like a frightened horse. "It is that devil," he whispered. "He is treating another as he treated me. But on, for heaven help us if he lays his hands upon us." One by one we crawled down the narrow goat track. At the bottom of the cliff we were back in the woods once more. Suddenly a yellow glare shone above us, and the black shadows of the tree trunks started out in front. They had fired the beacon behind us. Even from where we stood we could see that impassive body amid the flames, and the black figures of the guerrillas, as they danced, howling like cannibals, round the pile. Ha! How I shook my fist at them, the dogs, and how I vowed that one day my hussars and I would make the reckoning level. De Pombal knew how the outposts were placed and all the paths which led through the forest, but to avoid these villains we had to plunge among the hills and walk for many a weary mile. And yet how gladly would I have walked those extra leagues, if only for one sight which they brought to my eyes. It may have been 2 o'clock in the morning when we halted upon the bare shoulder of a hill over which our path curled. Looking back, we saw the red glow of the embers of the beacon, as if volcanic fires were bursting from the tall peak of Meridal. And then, as I gazed, I saw something else, something which caused me to shriek with joy and to fall upon the ground, rolling in my delight. For far away upon the southern horizon, there winked and twinkled one great yellow light, throbbing and flaming, the light of no house, the light of no star, but the answering beacon of Mount Dossa, which told that the army of Clausel knew what Etienne Gerard had been sent to tell them. End of section 11. An end of How the Brigadiers Saved the Army. Section 12 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Triumphed in England. I have told you, my friends, how I triumphed over the English at the fox hunt, when I pursued the animal so fiercely that even the herd of trained dogs was unable to keep up, and alone with my own hand I put him to the sword. Perhaps I have said too much of the matter, but there is a thrill in the triumphs of sport which even warfare cannot give. For in warfare you share your successes with your regiment and your army, but in sport it is you yourself unaided who have won the laurels. It is an advantage which the English have over us, that in all classes they take great interest in every form of sport. It may be that they are richer than we, or it may be that they are more idle. But I was surprised when I was a prisoner in that country to observe how widespread was this feeling, and how much it filled the minds and the lives of the people. A horse that will run, a cock that will fight, a dog that will kill rats, a man that will box, they would turn away from the emperor in all his glory in order to look upon any of these. I could tell you many stories of English sport,
for I saw much of it during the time that I was the guest of Lord Rufton, after the order for my exchange had come to England. There were months before I could be sent back to France, and during this time I stayed with this good Lord Rufton at his beautiful house of High Combe, which is at the northern end of Dartmoor. He had ridden with the police when they had pursued me from Princetown, and he had felt toward me when I was overtaken, as I would myself have felt had I, in my own country, seen a brave and debonair soldier without a friend to help him. In a word, he took me to his house, clad me, fed me, and treated me as if he had been my brother. I will say this of the English, that they were always generous enemies, and very good people with whom to fight. In the peninsula, the Spanish outposts would present their muskets at ours, but the British their brandy flasks. And of all these generous men, there was none who was the equal of this admirable milord, who held out so warm a hand to an enemy in distress. Ah, what thoughts of sport it brings back to me, the very name of High Combe. I can see it now, the long, low brick house, warm and ruddy, with white plaster pillars before the door. He was a great sportsman, this Lord Rufton, and all who were about him were of the same sort. But you will be pleased to hear that there were few things in which I could not hold my own, and in some I excelled. Behind the house was a wood in which pheasants were reared, and it was Lord Rufton's joy to kill these birds, which was done by sending in men to drive them out, while he and his friends stood outside and shot them as they passed. For my part, I was more crafty, for I studied the habits of the bird, and stealing out in the evening, I was able to kill a number of them as they roosted in the trees. Hardly a single shot was wasted, but the keeper was attracted by the sound of the firing, and he implored me, in his rough English fashion, to spare those that were left. That night I was able to place 12 birds as a surprise upon Lord Rufton's supper-table, and he laughed until he cried, so overjoyed was he to see them. "God, Gerard, you'll be the death of me yet," he cried. Often he said the same thing, for at every turn I amazed him by the way in which I entered into the sports of the English. There is a game called cricket, which they play in the summer, and this also I learned. Rudd, the head gardener, was a famous player of cricket, and so was Lord Rufton himself. Before the house was a lawn, and here it was that Rudd taught me the game. It is a brave pastime, a game for soldiers, for each tries to strike the other with the ball, and it is but a small stick with which you may ward it off. Three sticks behind show the spot beyond which you may not retreat. I can tell you that it is no game for children, and I will confess that, in spite of my 9 campaigns, I felt myself turn pale when first the ball flashed past me. So swift was it that I had not time to raise my stick to ward it off, but by good fortune it missed me and knocked down the wooden pins which marked the boundary. It was for Rudd then to defend himself and for me to attack. When I was a boy in Gascony, I learned to throw both far and straight, so that I made sure that I could hit this gallant Englishman. With a shout, I rushed forward and hurled the ball at him. It flew as swift as a bullet toward his ribs, but without a word, he swung his staff and the ball rose a surprising distance in the air. Lord Rufton clapped his hands and cheered. Again the ball was brought to me, and again it was for me to throw. This time it flew past his head, and it seemed to me that it was his turn to look pale. But he was a brave man, this gardener, and again he faced me. Ah, my friends, the hour of my triumph had come. It was a red waistcoat that he wore, and at this I hurled the ball. You would have said that I was a gunner, not a hussar, for never was so straight an aim. With despairing cry, the cry of the brave man who is beaten, he fell upon the wooden pegs behind him, and they all rolled upon the ground together. He was cruel, this English milord, and he laughed so that he could not come to the aid of his servant. It was for me, the victor, to rush forward to embrace this intrepid player, and to raise him to his feet with words of praise and encouragement and hope. He was in pain and could not stand erect, yet the honest fellow confessed that there was no accident in my victory. "He did it a purpose! He did it a purpose!" Again and again he said it. Yes, it is a great game, this cricket, and I would gladly have ventured upon it again, but Lord Rufton and Rudd said that it was late in the season, and so they would play no more. How foolish of me, the old broken man, to dwell upon these successes! And yet I will confess that my age has been very much soothed and comforted by the memory of the women who have loved me, and the men whom I have overcome. It is pleasant to think that 5 years afterward, when Lord Rufton came to Paris after the peace, he was able to assure me that my name was still a famous one in the north of Devonshire for the fine exploits that I had performed. Especially, he said, they still talked over my boxing match with the Honourable Baldock. It came about in this way. Of an evening, many sportsmen would assemble at the house of Lord Rufton, where they would drink much wine, make wild bets, and talk of their horses and their foxes. How well I remember those strange creatures! Sir Barrington, Jack Lupton of Barnstable, Colonel Addison, Johnny Miller, Lord Sadler, and my enemy, the Honourable Baldock. They were of the same stamp, all of them. Drinkers, madcaps, fighters, gamblers, full of strange caprices and extraordinary whims. Yet they were kindly fellows in their rough fashion, save only this Baldock, a fat man who prided himself on his skill at the box-fight. It was he who, by his laughter against the French because they were ignorant of sport, caused me to challenge him in the very sport at which he excelled. You will say that it was foolish, my friends, but the decanter had passed many times, and the blood of youth ran hot in my veins. I would fight him, this boaster. I would show him that if we had not skill, at least we had courage. Lord Rufton would not allow it. I insisted. The others cheered me on and slapped me on the back. "No, dash it, Baldock, he's our guest," said Rufton. "It's his own doing," the other answered. "Look here, Rufton, they can't hurt each other if they wear the maulies," cried Lord Sadler. And so it was agreed. What the maulies were, I did not know, but presently they brought out 4 great puddings of leather, not unlike a fencing glove, but larger. With these our hands were covered after we had stripped ourselves of our coats and our waistcoats. Then the table, with the glasses and decanters, was pushed into the corner of the room, and behold us, face to face, Lord Sadler sat in the armchair with a watch in his open hand. "Time," said he. I will confess to you, my friends, that I felt at that moment a tremor such as none of my many duels have ever given me. With sword or pistol I am at home, but here I only understood that I must struggle with this fat Englishman and do what I could, in spite of these great puddings upon my hands, to overcome him. And at the very outset I was disarmed of the best weapon that was left to me. "Mind, Gerard, no kicking," said Lord Rufton in my ear. I had only a pair of thin dancing slippers, and yet the man was fat, and a few well-directed kicks might have left me the victor. But there is an etiquette, just as there is in fencing, and I refrained. I looked at this Englishman, and I wondered how I should attack him. His ears were large and prominent. Could I seize them, I might drag him to the ground. I rushed in, but I was betrayed by this flabby glove, and twice I lost my hold. He struck me, but I cared little for his blows, and again I seized him by the ear. He fell, and I rolled upon him and thumped his head upon the ground. How they cheered and laughed, these gallant Englishmen, and how they clapped me on the back. "Even money on the Frenchman," cried Lord Sadler. "He fights foul," cried my enemy, rubbing his crimson ears. "He savaged me on the ground." "You must take your chance of that," said Lord Rufton coldly. "Time," cried Lord Sadler, and once again we advanced to the assault. He was flushed, and his small eyes were as vicious as those of a bulldog. There was hatred on his face. For my part, I carried myself lightly and gaily. A French gentleman fights, but he does not hate. I drew myself up before him, and I bowed, as I have done in the duello. There can be grace and courtesy as well as defiance in a bow. I put all 3 into this one, with a touch of ridicule in the shrug which accompanied it. It was at this moment that he struck me. The room spun round me. I fell upon my back. But in an instant I was on my feet again and had rushed to a close combat. His ear, his hair, his nose, I seized them each in turn. Once again the mad joy of battle was in my veins. The old cry of triumph rose to my lips. "Vive l'Empereur!" I yelled as I drove my head into his stomach. He threw his arm round my neck, and holding me with one hand, he struck me with the other. I buried my teeth in his arm, and he shouted with pain. "Call him off, Rufton!" he screamed. "Call him off, man! He's worrying me!" They dragged me away from him. Can I ever forget it? The laughter, the cheering, the congratulations. Even my enemy bore me no ill will, for he shook me by the hand. For my part, I embraced him on each cheek. 5 years afterward, I learned from Lord Rufton that my noble bearing upon that evening was still fresh in the memory of my English friends. It is not, however, of my own exploits in sport that I wish to speak to you tonight, but it is of the Lady Jane Dacre, and the strange adventure of which she was the cause. Lady Jane Dacre was Lord Rufton's sister, and the lady of his household. I fear that until I came it was lonely for her, since she was a beautiful and refined woman, with nothing in common with those who were about her. Indeed, this might be said of many women in the England of those days, for the men were rude and rough and coarse, with boorish habits and few accomplishments, while the women were the most lovely and tender that I have ever known. We became great friends, the Lady Jane and I, for it was not possible for me to drink 3 bottles of port after dinner, like those Devonshire gentlemen, and so I would seek refuge in her drawing-room, where evening after evening she would play the harpsichord, and I would sing the songs of my own land. In those peaceful moments I would find a refuge from the misery which filled me, when I reflected that my regiment was left in the front of the enemy, without the chief whom they had learned to love and to follow. Indeed, I could have torn my hair when I read in the English papers of the fine fighting which was going on in Portugal and on the frontiers of Spain, all of which I had missed through my misfortune in falling into the hands of Milord Wellington. From what I have told you of the Lady Jane, you will have guessed what occurred, my friends. Etienne Gerard is thrown into the company of a young and beautiful woman. What must it mean for him? What must it mean for her? It was not for me, the guest, the captive, to make love to the sister of my host, but I was reserved. I was discreet. I tried to curb my own emotions and to discourage hers. For my own part, I fear that I betrayed myself, for the eye becomes more eloquent when the tongue is silent. Every quiver of my fingers as I turned over her music sheets told her my secret. But she was admirable. It is in these matters that women have a genius for deception. If I had not penetrated her secret, I should often have thought that she forgot even that I was in the house. For hours she would sit lost in a sweet melancholy, while I admired her pale face and her curls in the lamplight, and thrilled within me to think that I had moved her so deeply. Then at last I would speak, and she would start in her chair and stare at me with the most admirable pretense of being surprised to find me in the room. Ah, how I longed to hurl myself suddenly at her feet, to kiss her white hand, to assure her that I had surprised her secret, and that I would not abuse her confidence. But no, I was not her equal, and I was under her roof as a castaway enemy. My lips were sealed. I endeavoured to imitate her own wonderful affectation of indifference, but, as you may think, I was eagerly alert for every opportunity of serving her. One morning Lady Jane had driven in her phaeton to Okehampton, and I strolled along the road which led to that place in the hope that I might meet her on her return. It was the early winter, and banks of fading fern sloped down to the winding road. It is a bleak place, this Dartmoor, wild and rocky, a country of wind and mist. I felt as I walked that it is no wonder Englishmen should suffer from the spleen. My own heart was heavy within me, and I sat upon a rock by the wayside, looking out on the dreary view with my thoughts full of trouble and foreboding. Suddenly, however, as I glanced down the road, I saw a sight which drove everything else from my mind and caused me to leap to my feet with a cry of astonishment and anger. Down the curve of the road a phaeton was coming, the pony tearing along at full gallop. Within was the very lady whom I had come to meet. She lashed at the pony like one who endeavours to escape from some pressing danger, glancing ever backward over her shoulder. The bend of the road concealed from me what it was that had alarmed her, and I ran forward, not knowing what to expect. The next instant I saw the pursuer, and my amazement was increased at the sight. It was a gentleman in the red coat of an English fox-hunter, mounted on a great grey horse. He was galloping as if in a race, and the long stride of the splendid creature beneath him soon brought him up to the lady's flying carriage. I saw him stoop and seize the reins of the pony so as to bring it to a halt. The next instant he was deep in talk with the lady, he bending forward in his saddle and speaking eagerly, she shrinking away from him as if she feared and loathed him. You may think, my dear friends, that this was not a sight at which I could calmly gaze. How my heart thrilled within me to think that a chance should have been given to me to serve the Lady Jane. I ran. Oh, good Lord, how I ran! At last, breathless, speechless, I reached the phaeton. The man glanced up at me with his blue English eyes, but so deep was he in his talk that he paid no heed to me, nor did the lady say a word. She still leaned back, her beautiful pale face gazing up at him. He was a good-looking fellow, tall and strong and brown. A pang of jealousy seized me as I looked at him. He was talking low and fast, as the English do when they are in earnest. "I tell you, Jinny, it's you and only you that I love," said he. "Don't bear malice, Jinny. Let bygones be bygones. Come now, say it's all over." "No, never, George, never," she cried. A dusky red suffused his handsome face. The man was furious. "Why can't you forgive me, Jinny?"
"I can't forget the past."
"By George, you must! I've asked enough. It's time to order now. I'll have my rights, do you hear?" His hand closed upon her wrist. At last my breath had returned to me. "Madame," I said, as I raised my hat, "do I intrude, or is there any possible way in which I can be of service to you?" But neither of them minded me any more than if I had been a fly who buzzed between them. Their eyes were locked together. "I'll have my rights, I tell you. I've waited long enough."
"There's no use bullying, George."
"Do you give in?"
"No, never."
"Is that your final answer?"
"Yes, it is."
He gave a bitter curse and threw down her hand. "All right, my lady, we'll see about this." "Excuse me, sir," said I with dignity. "Oh, go to blazes," he cried, turning on me with his furious face. The next instant he had spurred his horse and was galloping down the road once more. Lady Jane gazed after him until he was out of sight, and I was surprised to see that her face wore a smile and not a frown. Then she turned to me and held out her hand.
"You are very kind, Colonel Gerard. You meant well, I am sure."
"Madame," said I, "if you can oblige me with the gentleman's name and address, I will arrange that he shall never trouble you again."
"No scandal, I beg of you," she cried.
"Madame, I could not so far forget myself. Rest assured that no lady's name would ever be mentioned by me in the course of such an incident. In bidding me to go to blazes, this gentleman has relieved me from the embarrassment of having to invent a cause of quarrel."
"Colonel Gerard," said the lady earnestly, "you must give me your word as a soldier and a gentleman that this matter goes no farther, and also that you will say nothing to my brother about what you have seen. Promise me."
"If I must."
"I hold you to your word. Now drive with me to High Combe, and I will explain as we go."
The first words of her explanation went into me like a sabre point. "That gentleman," said she, "is my husband."
"Your husband?"
"You must have known that I was married." She seemed surprised at my agitation. "I did not know."
"This is Lord George Dacre. We have been married 2 years. There is no need to tell you how he wronged me. I left him and sought a refuge under my brother's roof. Up till today he has left me there unmolested. What I must above all things avoid is the chance of a duel betwixt my husband and my brother. It is horrible to think of. For this reason Lord Rufton must know nothing of this chance meeting of today.
If my pistol could free you from this annoyance—"
"No, no, it is not to be thought of. Remember your promise, Colonel Gerard, and not a word at High Combe of what you have seen." her husband. I had pictured in my mind that she was a young widow. This brown-faced brute with his goat ablazes was the husband of this tender dove of a woman. Oh, if she would but allow me to free her from so odious an encumbrance. There is no divorce so quick and certain as that which I could give her. But a promise is a promise, and I kept it to the letter. My mouth was sealed.
End of section 12. Section 13 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Triumphed in England. Continued. In a week I was to be sent back from Plymouth to St. Malo, but it seemed to me that I might never hear the sequel of the story. And yet it was destined that it should have a sequel, and that I should play a very pleasing and honourable part in it. It was only 3 days after the event which I have described, when Lord Rufton burst hurriedly into my room. His face was pale, and his manner that of a man in extreme agitation. "Gerard," he cried, "have you seen Lady Jane Dacre?" I had seen her after breakfast, and it was now midday. "By heaven, there's villainy here," cried my poor friend, rushing about like a madman. "The bailiff has been up to say that a chaise and pair were seen driving full split down the Tavistock Road. The blacksmith heard a woman scream as it passed his forge. Jane has disappeared. By the Lord, I believe that she has been kidnapped by this villain Dacre." He rang the bell furiously. 2 horses, this instant," he cried. "Colonel Gerard, your pistols. Jane comes back with me this night from Gravel Hanger, or there will be a new master in Highcombe Hall." Behold us, then, within half an hour, like 2 knight-errants of old, riding forth to the rescue of this lady in distress. It was near Tavistock that Lord Dacre lived, and at every house and toll-gate along the road we heard the news of the flying post-chaise in front of us, so there could be no doubt whither they were bound. As we rode, Lord Rufton told me of the man whom we were pursuing. His name, it seems, was a household word throughout all England for every sort of mischief. Wine, women, dice, cards, racing, in all forms of debauchery, he had earned for himself a terrible name. He was of an old and noble family, and it had been hoped that he had sowed his wild oats when he married the beautiful Lady Jane Rufton. For some months he had indeed behaved well, and then he had wounded her feelings in their most tender part by some unworthy liaison. She had fled from his house and taken refuge with her brother, from whose care she had now been dragged once more against her will. I ask you if 2 men could have had a fairer errand than that upon which Lord Rufton and myself were riding. "That's Gravel Hanger," he cried at last, pointing with his crop, and there on the green side of a hill was an old brick and timber building, as beautiful as only an English country house can be. "There's an inn by the park gate, and there we shall leave our horses," he added. For my own part, it seemed to me that with so just a cause, we should have done best to ride boldly up to his door and summon him to surrender the lady. But there I was wrong, for the one thing which every Englishman fears is the law. He makes it himself, and when he has once made it, it becomes a terrible tyrant before whom the bravest quails. He will smile at breaking his neck, but he will turn pale at breaking the law. It seems, then, from what Lord Rufton told me, as we walked through the park, that we were on the wrong side of the law in this matter. Lord Dacre was in the right in carrying off his wife, since she did indeed belong to him, and our own position now was nothing better than that of burglars and trespassers. It was not for burglars to openly approach the front door. We could take the lady by force or by craft, but we could not take her by right, for the law was against us. This was what my friend explained to me as we crept up toward the shelter of a shrubbery which was close to the windows of the house. Thence we could examine this fortress, see whether we could effect a lodgment in it, and above all try to establish some communication with the beautiful prisoner inside. There we were, then, in the shrubbery, Lord Rufton and I, each with a pistol in the pockets of our riding coats, and with the most resolute determination in our hearts
that we should not return without the lady. Eagerly we scanned every window of the widespread house. Not a sign could we see of the prisoner or of anyone else, but on the gravel drive outside the door were the deep-sunk marks of the wheels of the chaise. There was no doubt that they had arrived. Crouching amongst the laurel bushes, we held a whispered council of wary, but a singular interruption brought it to an end. Out of the door of the house there stepped a tall, flaxen-haired man, such a figure as one would choose for the flank of a grenadier company. As he turned his brown face and his blue eyes towards us, I recognised Lord Dacre. With long strides he came down the gravel path, straight for the spot where we lay. "Come out, Ned!" he shouted. "You'll have the gamekeeper putting a charge of shot into you. Come out, man, and don't skulk behind the bushes." It was not a very heroic situation for us. My poor friend rose with a crimson face. I sprang to my feet also, and bowed with such dignity as I could muster. "Halloa, it's the Frenchman, is it?" said he, without returning my bow. "I've got a crow to pluck with him already. As to you, Ned, I knew you would be hot on our scent, and so I was looking out for you. I saw you cross the park and go to ground in the shrubbery. Come in, man, and let us have all the cards on the table." He seemed master of the situation, this handsome giant of a man, standing at his ease on his own ground, while we slunk out of our hiding-place. Lord Rufton had said not a word, but I saw by his darkened brow and his sombre eyes that the storm was gathering. Lord Dacre led the way into the house, and we followed close at his heels. He ushered us himself into an oak-panelled sitting-room, closing the door behind us. Then he looked me up and down with insolent eyes. "Look here, Ned," said he. "Time was when an English family could settle their own affairs in their own way. What has this foreign fellow got to do with your sister and my wife?" "Sir," said I, "permit me to point out to you that this is not a case merely of a sister or a wife, but that I am the friend of the lady in question, and that I have the privilege which every gentleman possesses of protecting a woman against brutality. It is only by a gesture that I can show you what I think of you." I had my riding glove in my hand, and I flicked him across the face with it. He drew back with a bitter smile, and his eyes were as hard as flint. "So you've brought your bully with you, Ned," said he. "You might at least have done your fighting yourself, if it must come to a fight." "So I will," cried Lord Rufton, "here and now." "When I've killed this swaggering Frenchman," said Lord Dacre. He stepped to a side table and opened a brass-bound case. "By gad," said he, "either that man or I go out of this room feet foremost. I meant well by you, Ned. I did, by George, but I'll shoot this lead captain of yours as sure as my name's George Dacre. Take your choice of pistols, sir, and shoot across this table. The barkers are loaded. Aim straight and kill me if you can, for by the Lord, if you don't, you're done." In vain Lord Rufton tried to take the quarrel upon himself. Two things were clear in my mind. One, that the Lady Jane had feared above all things that her husband and brother should fight. The other, that if I could but kill this big milord, then the whole question would be settled forever in the best way. Lord Rufton did not want him. Lady Jane did not want him. Therefore I, Etienne Gerard, their friend, would pay the debt of gratitude which I owed them by freeing them of this encumbrance. But indeed there was no choice in the matter, for Lord Dacre was as eager to put a bullet into me as I could be to do the same service to him. In vain Lord Rufton argued and scolded. The affair must continue. "Well, if you must fight my guest instead of myself, let it be tomorrow morning with two witnesses," he cried at last. "This is sheer murder across the table." "But it suits my humour, Ned," said Lord Dacre. "And mine, sir," said I. "Then I'll have nothing to do with it," cried Lord Rufton. "I tell you, George, if you shoot Colonel Gerard under these circumstances, you'll find yourself in the dock instead of on the bench. I won't act as second, and that's flat." "Sir," said I am perfectly prepared to proceed without a second."
"That won't do. It's against the law," cried Lord Dacre. "Come, Ned, don't be a fool. You see we mean to fight. Hang it, man, all I want you to do is drop a handkerchief."
"I'll take no part in it."
"Then I must find someone who will," said Lord Dacre. He threw a cloth over the pistols which lay upon the table, and he rang the bell. A footman entered. "Ask Colonel Berkeley if he will step this way. You will find him in the billiard room." A moment later there entered a tall, thin Englishman with a great moustache, which was a rare thing amid that clean-shaven race. I have heard since that they were worn only by the guards and the hussars. This Colonel Berkeley was a guardsman. He seemed a strange, tired, languid, drawling creature, with a long black cigar thrusting out like a pole from a bush amidst that immense moustache. He looked from one to the other of us with true English phlegm, and he betrayed not the slightest surprise when he was told our intention.
"Quite so," said he, "quite so." "I refuse to act, Colonel Berkeley," cried Lord Rufton. "Remember, this duel cannot proceed without you, and I hold you personally responsible for anything that happens."
This Colonel Berkeley appeared to be an authority upon the question, for he removed the cigar from his mouth, and he laid down the law in his strange, drawling voice.
"The circumstances are unusual, but not irregular, Lord Rufton," said he. "This gentleman has given a blow, and this other gentleman has received it. That is a clear issue. Time and conditions depend upon the person who demands satisfaction. Very good. He claims it here and now across the table. He is acting within his rights. I am prepared to accept the responsibility."
There was nothing more to be said. Lord Rufton sat moodily in the corner, with his brows drawn down and his hands thrust deep into the pockets of his riding breeches. Colonel Berkeley examined the two pistols and laid them both in the centre of the table. Lord Dacre was at one end and I at the other, with 8 feet of shining mahogany between us. On the hearth rug, with his back to the fire, stood the tall colonel, his handkerchief in his left hand, his cigar between 2 fingers of his right.
"When I drop the handkerchief," said he, "you will pick up your pistols and you will fire at your own convenience. Are you ready?"
"Yes," we cried. His hand opened and the handkerchief fell. I bent swiftly forward and seized a pistol, but the table, as I have said, was 8 feet across, and it was easier for this long-armed milord to reach the pistols than it was for me. I had not yet drawn myself straight before he fired, and to this it was that I owe my life. His bullet would have blown out my brains had I been erect. As it was, it whistled through my curls. At the same instant, just as I threw up my own pistol to fire, the door flew open and a pair of arms were thrown around me. It was the beautiful, flushed, frantic face of Lady Jane, which looked up into mine.
"You shan't fire, Colonel Gerard. For my sake, don't fire," she cried. "It is a mistake, I tell you. A mistake, a mistake, a mistake. He is the best and dearest of husbands. Never again shall I leave his side."
Her hand slid down my arm and closed upon my pistol.
"Jane, Jane," cried Lord Rufton, "come with me. You should not be here. Come away." "It is all confoundedly irregular," said Colonel Berkeley.
"Colonel Gerard, you won't fire, will you? My heart would break if he were hurt."
"Hang it all, Jinny, give the fellow fair play," cried Lord Dacre. "He stood my fire like a man, and I won't see him interfered with. Whatever happens, I can't get worse than I deserve."
But already there had passed between me and the lady a quick glance of the eyes which told her everything. Her hand slipped from my arm.
"I leave my husband's life and my own happiness to Colonel Gerard," said she.
How well she knew me, this admirable woman! I stood for an instant irresolute, with the pistol cocked in my hand. My antagonist faced me bravely, with no blenching of his sunburnt face and no flinching of his bold blue eyes.
"Come, come, sir, take your shot," cried the colonel from the mat.
"Let us have it then," said Lord Dacre.
I would at least show them how completely his life was at the mercy of my skill. So much I owed to my own self-respect. I glanced round for a mark. The colonel was looking toward my antagonist, expecting to see him drop. His face was sideways to me, his long cigar projecting from his lips with an inch of ash at the end of it. Quick as a flash, I raised my pistol and fired. "Permit me to trim your ash, sir," said I, and I bowed with a grace which is unknown among these islanders. I'm convinced that the fault lay with the pistol, not with my own aim. I could hardly believe my own eyes when I saw that I had snapped off the cigar within half an inch of his lips. He stood staring at me with the ragged stub of the cigar end sticking out from his singed moustache. I can see him now with his foolish, angry eyes and his long, thin, puzzled face. Then he began to talk. I have always said that the English are not really a phlegmatic or a taciturn nation if you stir them out of their groove. No one could have talked in a more animated way than this colonel. Lady Jane put her hands over her ears. "Come, come, Colonel Barclay," said Lord Dacre sternly. "You forget yourself. There's a lady in the room." The colonel gave a stiff bow. "If Lady Dacre will kindly leave the room," said he, "I will be able to tell this infernal little Frenchman what I think of him and his monkey tricks." I was splendid at that moment, for I ignored the words that he had said and remembered only the extreme provocation. "Sir," said I freely offer you my apologies for this unhappy incident. I felt that if I did not discharge my pistol, Lord Dacre's honour might feel hurt, and yet it was quite impossible for me, after hearing what this lady has said, to aim it at her husband. I looked round for a mark, therefore, and I had the extreme misfortune to blow your cigar out of your mouth, when my intention had merely been to snuff the ash. I was betrayed by my pistol. This is my explanation, sir, and if, after listening to my apologies, you still feel that I owe you satisfaction, I need not say that it is a request which I am unable to refuse." It was certainly a charming attitude which I had assumed, and it won the hearts of all of them. Lord Dacre stepped forward and wrung me by the hand. "By George, sir," said he, "I never thought to feel toward a Frenchman as I do to you. You're a man and a gentleman, and I can't say more." Lord Rufton said nothing, but his hand grip told me all that he thought. Even Colonel Berkeley paid me a compliment and declared that he would think no more about the unfortunate cigar. And she, if you could have seen the look she gave me, the flushed cheek, the moist eye, the tremulous lip. When I think of my beautiful Lady Jane, it is at that moment that I recall her. They would have had me stay to dinner, but you will understand, my friends, that this was no time for either Lord Rufton or myself to remain at Gravel Hanger. This reconciled couple desired only to be alone. In the chaise he had persuaded her of his sincere repentance, and once again they were a loving husband and wife. If they were to remain so, it was best perhaps that I should go. Why should I unsettle this domestic peace? Even against my own will, my mere presence and appearance might have their effect upon the lady. No, I must tear myself away. Even her persuasions were unable to make me stop. Years afterward, I heard that the household of the Dacres was among the happiest in the whole country, and that no cloud had ever come again to darken their lives. Yet I dare say, if he could have seen into his wife's mind. But there, I say no more. A lady's secret is her own, and I fear that she and it are buried long years ago in some Devonshire churchyard. Perhaps all that gay circle are gone, and the Lady Jane only lives now in the memory of an old half-pay French brigadier. He, at least, can never forget. End of section 13, and end of How the Brigadier Triumphed in England. Section 14 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Rode to Minsk. I would have a stronger wine tonight, my friends, a wine of Burgundy rather than of Bordeaux.
"'It is that my heart, my old soldier heart, is heavy within me. "'It is a strange thing, this age which creeps upon one. "'One does not know, one does not understand. "'The spirit is ever the same, "'and one does not remember how the poor body crumbles. "'But there comes a moment when it is brought home, "'when quick as the sparkle of a whirling sabre, "'it is clear to us, and we see the men we were and the men we are.' "'Yes, yes, it was so to-day, and I would have a wine of Burgundy to-night. "'White Burgundy. Montrachet. Sir, I am your debtor.' "'It was this morning, in the Champ de Mars. "'Your pardon, friends, while an old man tells his trouble. "'You saw the review? Was it not splendid? "'I was in the enclosure for veteran officers who have been decorated. "'This ribbon on my breast was my passport.' The cross itself I keep at home, in a leathern pouch. They did us honour, for we were placed at the saluting point, with the Emperor and the carriages of the court upon our right. It is years since I have been to a review, for I cannot approve of many things which I have seen. I do not approve of the red breeches of the infantry. It was in white breeches that the infantry used to fight. Red is for the cavalry. A little more, and they would ask our busbies and our spurs. Had I been seen at a review, they might well have said that I, Etienne Gerard, had condoned it. So I have stayed at home. But this war of the Crimea is different. The men go to battle. It is not for me to be absent when brave men gather. My faith, they march well, those light infantrymen. They are not large, but they are very solid, and they carry themselves well. I took off my hat to them as they passed. Then there came the guns. They were good guns, well horsed and well manned. I took off my hat to them. Then came the engineers, and to them also I took off my hat. There are no braver men than the engineers. Then came the cavalry, lancers, cuirassiers, chasseurs, and spahis. To all of them in turn I was able to take off my hat, save only to the spahis. The Emperor had no spies, but when all of the others had passed, what think you came at the close? A brigade of hussars, and at the charge. Oh, my friends, the pride and the glory and the beauty, the flash and the sparkle, the roar of the hoofs and the jingle of chains, the tossing manes, the noble heads, the rolling cloud, and the dancing waves of steel. My heart drummed to them as they passed. And last of all, was it not my own old regiment? My eyes fell upon the grey and silver dolmans with the leopard-skin shabraques, and at that instant the years fell away from me, and I saw my own beautiful men and horses, even as they had swept behind their young colonel, in the pride of our youth and our strength, just 40 years ago. Up flew my cane. Charge! En avant! Vive l'Empereur! It was the past calling to the present, but oh, what a thin, piping voice! Was this the voice that had once thundered from wing to wing of a strong brigade, and the arm that could scarce wave a cane? Were these the muscles of fire and steel which had no match in all Napoleon's mighty host? They smiled at me, they cheered me, the Emperor laughed and bowed, but to me the present was a dim dream, and what was real were my 800 dead hussars and the Etienne of long ago. Enough. A brave man can face age and fate as he faced Cossacks and Uhlans, but there are times when Montrachet is better than the wine of Bordeaux. It is to Russia that they go, and so I will tell you a story of Russia. Ah, what an evil dream of the night it seems. Blood and ice, ice and blood. Fierce faces with snow upon the whiskers, blue hands held out for succour, and across the great white plain the one long black line of moving figures, trudging, trudging, 100 miles, another 100, and still always the same white plain. Sometimes there were fir woods to limit it, sometimes it stretched away to the cold blue sky, but the black line stumbled on and on. Those weary, ragged, starving men, the spirit frozen out of them, looked neither to right nor left, but but with sunken faces and rounded backs, trailed onward and ever onward, making for France as wounded beasts make for their lair. There was no speaking, and you could scarce hear the shuffle of feet in the snow. Only once I heard them laugh. It was outside Vilna, when an aide-de-camp rode up to the head of that dreadful column and asked if that were the Grand Army. All who were within hearing looked round, and when they saw those broken men, those ruined regiments, those fur-capped skeletons who were once the guard, they laughed, and the laugh crackled down the column like a feu de joie. I have heard many a groan and cry and scream in my life, but nothing so terrible as the laugh of the Grand Army. But why was it that these helpless men were not destroyed by the Russians? Why was it that they were not speared by the Cossacks or herded into droves and driven as prisoners into the heart of Russia? On every side, as you watched the black snake winding over the snow, you saw also dark moving shadows which came and went like cloud drifts on either flank and behind. They were the Cossacks, who hung round us like wolves round the flock. But the reason why they did not ride in upon us was that all the ice of Russia could not cool the hot hearts of some of our soldiers. To the end, there were always those who were ready to throw themselves between these savages and their prey. One man, above all, rose greater as the danger thickened, and won a higher name amid disaster than he had done when he led our van to victory. To him I drink this glass, to Ney, the red-maned lion, glaring back over his shoulder at the enemy who feared to tread too closely on his heels. I can see him now, his broad white face convulsed with fury, his light blue eyes sparkling like flints, his great voice roaring and crashing amid the roll of the musketry. His glazed and featherless cocked hat was the ensign upon which France rallied during those dreadful days. It is well known that neither I nor the regiment of Hussars of Conflans were at Moscow. We were left behind on the lines of communication at Borodino. How the Emperor could have advanced without us is incomprehensible to me, and indeed it was only then that I understood that his judgment was weakening and that he was no longer the man that he had been. However, a soldier has to obey orders, and so I remained at this village, which was poisoned by the bodies of 30,000 men who had lost their lives in the great battle. I spent the late autumn in getting my horses into condition and reclothing my men, so that when the army fell back on Borodino, my hussars were the best of the cavalry and were placed under Ney in the rear guard. What could he have done without us during those dreadful days? "Ah, Gerard," said he one evening. But it is not for me to repeat the words. Suffice it that he spoke what the whole army felt. The rear guard covered the army, and the Hussars of Conflans covered the rear guard. There was the whole truth in a sentence. Always the Cossacks were on us. Always we held them off. Never a day passed that we had not to wipe our sabres. That was soldiering indeed. But there came a time between Vilna and Smolensk when the situation became impossible. Cossacks and even cold we could fight, but we could not fight hunger as well. Food must be got at all costs. That night Ney sent for me to the wagon in which he slept. His great head was sunk on his hands. Mind and body he was wearied to death. "Colonel Gerard," said he, "things are going very badly with us. The men are starving. We must have food at all costs." "The horses," I suggested. "Save your handful of cavalry. There are none left." "The band," said I. He laughed, even in his despair. "Why the band?" he asked. "Fighting men are of value." "Good," said he. "You would play the game down to the last card, and so would I. Good, Gerard, good." He clasped my hand in his. "But there is one chance for us yet, Gerard." He unhooked a lantern from the roof of the wagon, and he laid it on a map which was stretched before him. "To the south of us," said he, "there lies the town of Minsk. I have a word from a Russian deserter that much corn has been stored in the town hall. I wish you to take as many men as you think best, set forth for Minsk, seize the corn, load any carts which you may collect in the town, and bring them to me between here and Smolensk. If you fail, it is but a detachment cut off. If you succeed, it is new life to the army." He had not expressed himself well, for it was evident that if we failed, it was not merely the loss of a detachment. It is quality as well as quantity which counts. And yet how honourable a mission and how glorious a risk! If mortal man could bring it, then the corn should come from Minsk. I said so, and spoke a few burning words about a brave man's duty, until the marshal was so moved that he rose and, taking me affectionately by the shoulders, pushed me out of the wagon. It was clear to me that in order to succeed in my enterprise, I should take a small force and depend rather upon surprise than upon numbers. A large body could not conceal itself, would have great difficulty in getting food, and would cause all the Russians around us to concentrate for its certain destruction. On the other hand, if a small body of cavalry could get past the Cossacks unseen, it was probable that they would find no troops to oppose them, for we knew that the main Russian army was several days' march behind us. This corn was meant, no doubt, for their consumption. A squadron of hussars and 30 Polish lancers were all whom I chose for the venture. That very night we rode out of the camp and struck south in the direction of Minsk. Fortunately, there was but a half moon, and we were able to pass without being attacked by the enemy. Twice we saw great fires burning amid the snow, and around them a thick bristle of long poles. These were the lances of Cossacks, which they had stood upright while they slept. It would have been a great joy to us to have charged in amongst them, for we had much to revenge, and the eyes of my comrades looked longingly from me to those red flickering patches in the darkness. My faith, I was sorely tempted to do it, for it would have been a good lesson to teach them that they must keep a few miles between themselves and a French army. It is the essence of good generalship, however, to keep one thing before one at a time, and so we rode silently on through the snow, leaving these Cossack bivouacs to right and left. Behind us the black sky was all mottled with a line of flame which showed where our own poor wretches were trying to keep themselves alive for another day of misery and starvation. All night we rode slowly onward, keeping our horses' tails to the pole star. There were many tracks in the snow, and we kept to the line of these, that no one might remark that a body of cavalry had passed that way. These are the little precautions which mark the experienced officer. Besides, by keeping to the tracks, we were most likely to find the villages, and only in the villages could we hope to get food. The dawn of day found us in a thick fir wood, the trees so loaded with snow that the light could hardly reach us. When we had found our way out of it, it was full daylight, the rim of the rising sun peeping over the edge of the great snow plain and turning it crimson from end to end. I halted my hussars and lancers under the shadow of the wood, and I studied the country. Close to us there was a small farmhouse. Beyond, at the distance of several miles, was a village. Far away on the skyline rose a considerable town, all bristling with church towers. This must be Minsk. In no direction could I see any sign of troops. It was evident that we had passed through the Cossacks, and that there was nothing between us and our goal. A joyous shout burst from my men when I told them our position, and we advanced rapidly toward the village. I have said, however, that there was a small farmhouse immediately in front of us. As we rode up to it, I observed that a fine grey horse with a military saddle was tethered by the door. Instantly I galloped forward, but before I could reach it, a man dashed out of the door, flung himself onto the horse, and rode furiously away, the crisp, dry snow flying up in a cloud behind him. The sunlight gleamed upon his gold epaulettes, and I knew that he was a Russian officer. He would raise the whole countryside if we did not catch him. I put spurs to Violette and flew after him. My troopers followed, but there was no horse among them to compare with Violette, and I knew well that if I could not catch the Russian, I need expect no help from them. But it is a swift horse indeed, and a skilful rider, who can hope to escape from Violette with Etienne Gerard in the saddle. He rode well, this young Russian, and his mount was a good one, but gradually we wore him down.
His face glanced continually over his shoulder. Dark, handsome face, with eyes like an eagle, and I saw as I closed with him that he was measuring the distance between us. Suddenly he half turned. There was a flash and a crack as his pistol bullet hummed past my ear. Before he could draw his sword, I was upon him, but he still spurred his horse, and the two galloped together over the plain, I with my leg against the Russian's and my left hand upon his right shoulder. I saw his hand fly up to his mouth. Instantly, I dragged him across my pommel and seized him by the throat so that he could not swallow. His horse shot from under him, but I held him fast, and Violette came to a stand. Sergeant Houdin of the Hussars was the first to join us. He was an old soldier, and he saw at a glance what I was after. "Hold tight, Colonel," said he. "I'll do the rest."
End of section 14.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.